Today is Wednesday, February 28th, the year 2001. We are in East Lansing, Michigan. I'm Jeff Charnley interviewing Dr. Maurice Crane for the MSU Oral History Project for the sesquicentennial of Michigan State to be commemorated in the year 2005. Dr. Crane is Emeritus Director of the G. Robert Vincent Voice Library here at Michigan State. And Professor Crane, as you can see, we've got a tape recorder here today. Do you give us permission to record this interview?
I do.
I'd like to start first with some questions about your background and professional education. Where were you born and raised?
I was born in Atlantic City, New Jersey on the 6th of June, 1926.
Your parents, what were their names?
My father was William James Crane. My mother was Luba Davidson Crane.
Mm-hmm. Where did you go to school?
I went to Atlantic City High School. I went to Princeton University. I went to Villanova University. I went to the University of Chicago. I taught at and got a PhD at the University of Illinois. Later, I took courses at Ryukyu Daigaku in Okinawa and at Cambridge University in England.
How did World War II affect your life, the timing of
that? It was great. I know people aren't supposed to say that. I know we're not supposed to say that, but my 18th birthday was on June 6, 1944. I got into the war too late to be in harm's way. I went directly to Princeton University, where I took a pre-med course, completed it in 16 months, by which time the bombs had fallen on Nagasaki and Hiroshima. I went out to sea for a very short time and got more GI Bill than anybody knew what to do with. For every month at Princeton, I got a free month at Chicago. Mm-hmm. You know, you can hardly beat them apples. Shortly before I ran out of GI Bill, I got a teaching assistantship in the English department at Illinois, and as I left Chicago with a brand new master's in 50, I left Illinois with a brand new PhD in 53, having taught full time for 3 years, gone to school, taken my German, my French, my prelims, my orals, written my dissertation. As far as I can tell, I didn't learn anything, but I had a PhD, and it was all free. And I was ready to start my education, which I got here at Michigan State.
Mm-hmm. What, were you married at that time?
We got married at the time. I got my master's degree in June of 50. We got married March 26, 1950. I said to people when I retired last year that we got married 50 years ago, and I started college teaching 50 years ago. I looked at both contracts, and only one of them mentioned death. So I said, it's time to quit. I quit the Michigan State University, not in anger, not in weakness. I thought 50 years was such a round number. I didn't know where I'd find, I didn't want to go 100, I couldn't go 100, and I didn't want to go 60. We were married. We had two children at Illinois. My wife says we've had four children. She says we had four children. We had one child by, we had children by every known means of birth control.
What's your wife's name?
Elaine. She was Elaine Neff. She went to Atlantic City High School also. We met in junior high. She went to the University of Pennsylvania. When I said I was going to graduate school at Chicago, she said she was too. It was a fake. We were going, I don't know anybody except us who went to the University of Chicago to have a good time. That's not what that school's set up for. If you want to have a good time, you go to Michigan State. But we had a good time, and we got married, and we had kids, and somehow or other, when she was pregnant with our daughter Abigail, who turned 50 last Friday, on the 23rd, as we got pregnant after 2 months of marriage, she taught third grade. I guess she taught high school before we were married. She taught at Unity High of Tolono, and then she taught out in St. Joseph, Illinois. And we saved every penny she earned, and when we got to this town, we had money for a down payment on a house. So I was 27, she was 25. We had two kids. We were buying a house, and I was teaching for Paul Bagwell. I was teaching the freshman comp course here, which was called Communication Skills, because they keep changing the name of the freshman course in the hope that the kids will like it. That course, Paul Bagwell had advertised fallaciously. He had advertised for people with master's degrees, telling them they would never have to get PhDs. And so people like Ben Stranis, Ben Hickok, Ken McCrory, Glenn Swarthout, Bob Wright, good men, came here told that they wouldn't have to get PhDs. After they got here, they changed the law and told them they did. Ken went off to Columbia, Bob Wright went off back to the Korean War and then to Columbia. But Glenn and Ben and lots of others took their PhDs here from the English department, which had created communication skills so they could hire people telling them they'd never have to teach freshmen. It's a madness. These were all extremely good guys. Paul Bagwell subsequently ran for governor and lost, a wonderful bit of news for the state of Michigan.
That he lost?
That he lost. He ran against Soapy Williams, and then he ran against John Swainson. I should say this, when I came here, it was called Michigan State College. The governor's name was Soapy. The football coach's name was Biggie. The president was called universally Uncle John.
Uncle John.
And we were teaching in Quonset huts on South Campus, which they called the Clapboard Jungle. We taught in temporary buildings. We are sitting now on ground where the band shell used to be.
In Bessie Hall.
In Bessie Hall. We're sitting in Bessie Hall, where they destroyed the band shell and they destroyed the forestry cabin, and they promised, let's see, they destroyed the both of them in about 61, I think, and they promised to rebuild both of them. They haven't rebuilt them, but it's not malice, because you know, Michigan State University is not run by malice, it's run by stupidity. And as they say, you can cure malice, but stupidity is forever. You know? They built this very nice building where I had offices while I taught humanities. Anyway, go ahead.
What did you study at Illinois?
My PhD is in American literature. I wrote on Nathaniel Hawthorne at Brook Farm, and about the Blithedale romance that grew out of it. I never took anything seriously. Until I was a grown man in my 30s, I didn't know the difference between cleverness and intelligence. And I think I just got by exclusively on cleverness. I went into my doctoral orals. I was teaching in a degree in the department which I got my degree, and I knew all these guys. We went to coffee, which was a nickel in those days. And a teaching assistantship paid quite a bit. It paid enough for you to get married and start a family on. I used to refer to Hawthorne as Nat King Hawthorne. And then I just started calling him King. Mm-hmm. And I went into my orals, and John Flanagan says, well, what did King think of this? These guys, I was about 25 when I went in. I was as just 27 when I came here, and I looked 14, and I didn't take it seriously. Yeah, nobody should be able to get a master's in 50, a PhD in 53, while teaching full time. You just can't do, you can't do it well, but kids are arrogant. I thought I did a wonderful, I thought I was a great teacher. Everybody thinks he's a great teacher. Everybody didn't think he was a great teacher. You know. And I came here thinking I would, might teach freshman comp all my life, because I liked it. I just, a series of crazy things happened to me, and I went from one career to another without ever leaving home, you know.
What were your impressions of the campus when you first arrived?
Oh, I loved it. I used to tell people I wrote the alma mater at the University of Illinois, not the one that says hail to the orange, hail to the blue, but the one that goes, I get no kick from champagne. Of course, I didn't write that. Cole Porter wrote that. But Steve Ellison down here taught with me at Illinois. Steve Ellison's a Phi Beta Kappa from Harvard. He did very well at Chicago. And he came here after me. Everybody came after me. I was the youngest man in the department. God, for years, about 10 years, I was the youngest man in the department, in whatever department I was in. And I was writing and publishing and doing all kinds of silly stuff. I guess I never took it seriously. Anyway, I was in American Lit. And whether you're in American Lit or in anything, you have to take all that Anglo-Saxon, you know. And I thought that was hilarious. It was a game. And as I say, I really didn't know that I wasn't deep. I just thought clever was fine. I thought glib was fine. And it got me through not only teaching, but show business and other things.
Yeah. When did you change your department here?
I went into humanities January 1st, 57. I was been 3 1/2 years, 3 1/3 years teaching. What happened is Dean was Ed Carlin. Ed had just replaced Tom Hamilton. Tom went off to run the State University of New York, the job that Cliff Wharton later got, and then Tom went off to run the University of Hawaii. Tom was a guy very much like me. He wasn't ever very serious about anything. He was a very good basketball player and a quite good jazz drummer. And I met him the day I came here to interview for a job. And Dean Erickson was taking Paul Bagwell around, and Tom was taking me around, and bop jokes had just come in, and so we were telling bebop jokes to one another. And the week we arrived on campus, we were over at a party at Tom's house. At any rate, Tom left. No, he left to become, not provost, but vice president at Michigan State. Ed Carlin took his job. Ed was a friend, too. And Ed's first speech was, we've got to understand each other's departments. The University College was broken up into four unequal segments, you know. And there's no secret about it. Everybody thought humanities was wonderful. It's maybe the reason they closed it down. I don't know. Everybody thought humanities was wonderful. And wasn't nuts about natural science or social science or communication skills. He talked about how we should know. So I went into him and I said, I'd like very much to teach all of the departments. I'd like to teach social science. That's the one I want to teach first. He was a social scientist. Oh, no. That's it. You got to have training to teach social science. You know, easy to teach history, but when you teach history with the facts left out, that takes. And I want to teach natural science because I had taken genetics and embryology and comparative anatomy and all that stuff. And he says, you know, you ought to be all right in humanities. But he was afraid of Harry Kimber, who terrified people. And he says, well, you go talk to Harry Kimber. I caught Harry Kimbrough on a very good day. He thought I was the cutest thing since sliced bread. We had a wonderful time together always. I visited him when he was dying over in Bertram Hills. He gave me all kinds of wonderful private stuff, books. We became very, very good friends. Anyway, I went in the humanities department in the belief that I would then teach natural science and social science. At the end of my second quarter of, I was teaching both communication skills and humanities. Kimber called me and says, Crane, we can't do this. You can't do this. You got to choose one department or the other. So I chose humanities. I went into humanities. A year and a half later, the Honors College started having honors courses, and he decided I would be the honors man. Those kids all, this was in 59, 60, 61. Those kids, if they were 19 at the time, are now 61 years old. And they include people like Ken Beechler. Ken's actually 64 because he'd been in the service. But wonderful, wonderful, wonderful people. And since there was no rules for Honors College, I said, here's what you do. You take the regular course, and every Sunday night will come to my house. This is voluntary. I don't get paid for it. You don't get credit for it. We will read those great books that everybody says he's going to read someday, and nobody reads, because if we read everything we had to, we wouldn't go to college. That's what smart people do, you know. A whaling vessel was my Harvard College and my Yale. And we read things like Fustel de Coulanges, The Ancient City, and we read Skepticism and Animal Faith, and we read Religion and the Rise of Capitalism. And then we read things, primary materials like Coriolanus and Lear, and things that people are going to read and don't, you know. And we did that around the clock, because at the end of the first year, a group of kids led by McKay Sunwall and Ron English came into me and said, listen, we're going to be here this summer. Can we? And I said, yeah, you select the books, but they can't be silly books. Well, there were The Causes of World War III was one of them. But we didn't think it was a silly book at the time. It was the summer of 60, and we thought there would be a World War III. And these kids came over to my house, and my wife baked cookies, and we made coffee till I found out that Mac and another guy, Tyson, were both Mormons and couldn't drink coffee. So there I was running a cafeteria. I was also serving milk, you know. Mac wouldn't take coffee ice cream, but he went and got a PhD. He went off from here to Harvard, and he's teaching something. So, he was a psych major. He became an English major under my influence, because his father was a PhD in psych. And I'm sorry, but that's what happened. I don't know how I got, anyway, I taught this wonderful group of kids, and I still talk to some of them. Well, I talk to Kenny all the time. Barbara Roll was in for her mother's funeral. I ran into one of them in the Vatican, Mary Russo. I can name the kids in that class, and they were at my house every Sunday evening. And that was really the beginning of the healthy Honors College that we had here.
Mm-hmm. Not very bureaucratic at all.
Oh, no, and then we had a free university in the 60s, I guess, maybe early 70s here. And I just told the kids that, this was at Wilson Hall, if they found a serious book to discuss, I would, oh, and in this class I had guests so that I wouldn't screw them up. I had somebody for that book, the best man. I used to use Hal Walsh a lot in philosophy, and but Dick Sullivan was one of my guys, and I don't know, all kinds of wonderful people, Carl Thompson. And so we would sit there, and I did this because I felt that if we ran out of things to say, I could have a dialogue. And I was learning all kinds of wonderful stuff. I was reading books I hadn't read. And it was good. Those were very, very, very good times. By this time, I had moved to my current house, which is pompous. You know, it's a great, large, it's on three lots at East Lansing, you know. It's a great, big, I don't think it's pompous anymore because everybody's buying pompous houses. But it was strange in those days. I talk to these people now in their 60s. I think about it, the first 18-year-olds I had in 1950 are now 69. 69 years old. These fresh-faced little kids, they're retired. And they're eating meals at half price at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, you know.
Did you see a difference in the students when you first got here from those in the 60s? Was there a difference?
Oh, yeah. There's an editorial in today's State News about it's angry because there's a new movie, and in it the Michigan State kids are talking about sex and booze, and the guys from the University of Michigan are talking about their coursework. And I don't know why these kids are angry. The rest of the newspaper is about sex and booze, you know. I don't think it's Michigan State. I think kids in general have gotten disappointed with authority. I voted for Bill Clinton twice. I like him very much. But... we didn't have presidents of the United States. Well, we did have, actually, presidents of the United States, but they were quiet about it, and the press was quiet about it, and we didn't know everything about everybody. And now the kids have always treated me with respect. I heard that kids don't treat people with respect. I never had that. Every Friday, I go and visit the people who used to work for me in the Voice Library. John is 50, Rick is 45. And they call me Dr. Crane and Sir, and we spend Christmas and Thanksgiving and 4th of July together, you know.
This is John Shaw.
This is John Shaw.
And who was the other person
Rick
you mentioned?
Rick Pfeiffer. He's our engineer. Mm-hmm. These are marvelous people. I've had very good luck. I've had just great students. The recently retired president of Drake University in Des Moines, Iowa, Michael J. Ferrari, used to chauffeur me around because I used to give speeches out in the countryside, and I hated to drive, and he was my driver. Mm-hmm. And. He's a guy with 3 degrees from Michigan State, and he's been a college president. He was a college president for a while at Bowling Green. He was provost mainly, and he was interim president. When they didn't make him president, he went off to Drake.
What were some of the courses you taught in the humanities, besides the honors course?
Yeah, I taught the three courses, you know, about the ancient world, you know, the Aristotle, Plato, and Bible course. The Middle Ages, the Dante, Chaucer, Shakespeare course, and the Modern, which was Darwin, Marx, Freud course. I taught Japanese, cultural traditions of Japan. I did that because they were given a free trip to University of Okinawa to take courses and to teach. When I took it, I didn't know there were hooks attached, but I taught that. I taught the modern course, whatever that is. It's post-World War II. And I think popular culture I taught in the English department. I taught a series of just fun courses in Justin Marlborough College. I taught jazz history and history of comedy. And
But Humanities wasn't part of Justin Morrill?
No. Justin Morrill was run the way James Madison is successfully run and Lyman Briggs is semi-successfully run. They were going to have residential college. It just got very expensive. Mm-hmm. They wanted to give kids the Swarthmore Reed Carleton experience while coming to a campus that could bring in the London Philharmonic and the Notre Dame football team. And this was the arts college, and it just kept changing its self-definition all the time. But I had wonderful, and I'm in contact with many of those kids today, and they're in their 50s. As I taught there in 66 and 67, 68 maybe. Gordon said he would get the finest teachers on campus to teach. Well, he got who we could get, you know. It's like Clarence Thomas was the finest man you could find in the Supreme Court if you're limiting yourself to black conservatives, you know. He got the guys who were willing. But there were guys, John F. A. Taylor and Russ Nye, guys that did teach there, and they were fun guys, and we all became very close friends of one another.
What was it about Professor Nye that, you know, did you work with him directly, or how did you come to know him?
He's one of the finest people who ever lived, and he was incredibly modest, so that if you were to say to him, I've got a theory that Moby Dick was a flea, you know, he would say, Jeff, that's a wonderful idea. And he'd start feeding you bibliography from literature and from entomology, you know. I just made that up, but he was so good. He was teaching popular culture courses, and he would have me in as a jazz expert and a comedy expert. And not that he didn't know more than I did, it's that he didn't know that he knew more. Russ and I used to go every summer to Davenport, Iowa for the Bix Beiderbecke. We went from the Dixieland Festival, and we started when it started, and we ended the year he had his stroke, which was 85. And
was he a musician?
No. His son, Pete, he has only one child, who's in his early 60s now. Pete is a jazz trumpet player and a jazz guitarist. And but he's a race car driver, that's what he does. I knew Pete, I played with Pete when I was the faculty advisor of the jazz club, because you couldn't have a club without a faculty advisor in those days. And it fell to me to be the faculty advisor of that club, most likely to have people smoking marijuana at its meetings. I didn't have tenure at the time, but I got to play a lot with these kids. I hadn't played at it, and then I did play. I've quit jazz about six times in my life, always for the same reason. It get to be no fun. It gets to be no fun when you're an administrator, when you're a band leader, when you got to tell people to stop drinking or get on a stand or wear a clean shirt or whatever. But I knew Pete that way. Pete was also a student of mine. He took the medieval Renaissance humanities from me. This was not in the Honors College, but it was a very good class he was in. I do have a memory for classes, you know, and that was a good bunch of kids. And and these were kids that I hung out with. I was blessed or cursed with looking like a kid for a long time. That's over, and it's been over for a long time. But they let me come around because I blew a horn and I was fun to be with, I guess. I don't know why.
What instruments did you play?
I played the clarinet, really.
Or do you play?
I play the clarinet now. I was a hard bop alto man. I play the tenor, but I don't own a tenor. My children went off to college and took my saxophones with them. I had a hard time figuring out whether they were good or bad, because by the time they went to college, everybody was playing rock and roll, and I have difficulty telling a good rock tenor man from a bad one. I don't think there's much difference, but I may be wrong about that. I heard the other day a definition of perfect pitch. Perfect pitch is when you throw an accordion into a dumpster and it hits a banjo. That is a perfect pitch. But, you know, they're up to their ears in jokes like this. The difference between a trampoline and a bagpipe is people take their shoes off when they jump on a trampoline. And the difference between a banjo and an onion is nobody cries when he cuts up a banjo.